Don't you wish your life came with a warning app?
That dog does not want to be petted.
Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the one-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
Hey, I'm Veronica Dagger, and this is the Wall Street Journal Secrets of Wealthy Women, where women share how they tackle career, money, and the world. Knowing you can survive a personal crisis may empower you to handle other types of crises like the one we're in due to the coronavirus. Julie Smolansky knows this well. She is the CEO of Lifeway Foods, which is known for its probiotic milk drink called Kefir. It's like drinkable yogurt, and her family helped bring it to the mainstream here in the U.S. Before the pandemic started, we interviewed Julie, who took over Lifeway from her parents. She was the youngest female CEO of a publicly traded company at the time, and she's still one of the youngest. Taking over was a huge challenge for Julie, and now almost two decades later, she faces new ones. How to keep her family business on top, and adapting the business during the coronavirus crisis, all amid more competition and changing consumer tastes. Now Julie's had to face fresh challenges. Part of this episode was recorded before the pandemic. At the end, we recently got back in touch with Julie. So welcome, Julie.
Thanks for having me, Veronica.
My pleasure.
Yeah.
And so for those of us who've never heard of Kefir, many of us have, but for those who haven't, what is it and why is it so important to your family?
Sure. So kefir is a fermented dairy product that's about 2,000 years old that originated in the Caucasus Mountains, which is a region that is where like Russia and Ukraine is. And my parents and I were refugees from the former Soviet Union. And so this is kefir is something that my ancestors knew about, that they continued to use generation to generation, and it survived through word of mouth. The cultures create the gases that create this effervescence. And it's a probiotic. It's actually the original probiotic. And so my ancestors intuitively knew how to heal their bodies through this product.
So how did your family bring kefir to America?
When my parents were growing up in the Soviet Union, they hated life there. I mean, they were stifled. They were persecuted. And so both my mother and father had dreams of escaping the Soviet Union. And so through a slit in the Iron Curtain in 1976, 1 year after I was born, my parents defected. And we were in exile in Rome for 3 months. And then we landed in Chicago. We were the first of 48 families that were settled in Chicago at that time from that immigration group. And my parents really paved the way for a lot of other immigrants who came this way, and they trailblazed. And along the way, my mother opened the first Russian deli, and that sort of was, again, an intuitive sense of, you know, feeding your family, feeding your community. So food was really a part of my family's, you know, history and prosperity, too. And so along the way, my father was an engineer, and he, you know, they were 10 years into the immigration process in Germany at a trade show to buy food for their deli. And at that point, my mom became an importer and distributor of Eastern European food. She was cutting international deals with people all over the world. My dad bought the first 3 bottles of kefir there in Germany in 1985. And he said, "Oh, my God, America has everything, but it doesn't have kefir." And my mom said, "Well, you're an engineer. You should make it and, you know, build a plant, make the product, and I'll sell it through my distribution system." And 6 months later, they incorporated Lifeway Foods. Kefir now exists in America because of immigration, because my parents had bravely taken this risk to venture into this unknown journey of life in America. And, you know, we're now 33 years in business, and I've been running it for like 17 years.
Such a neat story.
Yeah.
What were your first memories of the business?
Yeah, I mean, I remember I was about 11 years old and being in our basement in the North Shore suburbs of Skokie in our little townhouse. I remember my father working on batch after batch and just these pots and pots of fermentation happening in the basement, like bubbling and like always like tasting all of these various, you know, pots of fermentation and, you know, fermented milk and lots of milk.
Weird?
I loved it. Yeah. I just absolutely loved it. I love the taste of like that tart, tangy cultured milk. I really, really love the taste.
So you were in the basement and you saw your dad working on this for hours at a time and going to the office, presumably. Were you right away? Were you like, I want to be part of this business?
No. I wanted nothing to do with it. You know, I resented the business, actually, for taking my parents away. Mm. I really was angry that they were never there. But they were working. And, I mean, I'm so grateful today, of course. But at the time, I was, a kid, and I just wanted to be with my parents. But, and this idea of, like, work-life balance, it's interesting. It's a luxury. It's for immigrants, for first-generation immigrants. That's not a concept. My parents, there were months where I didn't see my dad. Like, 3 months would go by, but he was putting food on the table. I mean, we came to America with $116.
Wow.
We were the first families here. They didn't speak a word of English. My mom learned English watching General Hospital.
Incredible.
They had to start from the ground up in their 20s with an infant I can't even articulate the challenges that they had to go through. And so I wanted nothing to do with the business. I wanted to be a psychologist and I wanted to change the world, as cliche as that sounds. I wanted to help people, and I started that process, and I was in grad school. And I was studying psychology. I'd never taken a business class. It was the biggest fight my dad and I had when I was in high school and college, was that I didn't take a business class, and he really wanted me to take over the business. And I was adamant that I was not going to do that. And serendipity, I was in the field working in the field in psychology. I was working as an in-home family counselor in Chicago. I was in really rough neighborhoods, really naive about where I was and what I was doing. And really unprepared, but also, anyways, I had an experience. It wasn't a good one, and I quit my job that night. And I just called my dad and said, "Hey, can I just work for you like 10 hours a week data entry while I finished grad school?" But within 2 weeks, I fell in love with what he was doing, and I just finally clicked. And this vision, this mission, this purpose that I had of wanting to help people or improve people's lives, I found a path to doing that by helping my family in the business and my father. But I'd always thought that kefir was just this Russian product from my grandmother, and I didn't think it was cool. And I was in the office doing data entry for my dad, and I was listening to how he was talking about it and marketing and talking to the customers. It's like lightning hit me, and I just it clicked. And then the call came, and then I was like, that's it. I know exactly what I'm going to do for the rest of my life.
So you said you initially resented your parents for the business and because they spent so much time there. Did working at the company change your relationship with your parents?
Very much so. I think that what I also really enjoyed was working with my father in the 5 years that I got to and learn from him. And we really repaired our relationship in a lot of ways. We had some of the greatest conversations, really fun business journeys and travel. And he was really proud of me. I mean, I had my first sales call. I just called the buyer up out of the blue after a customer called and asked for a product at his local grocery store. It was Lucky's. I still remember Miriam Welch. She took the call. She was the category manager. And she invited me in to see her. And my parents had never sent me on a trip. I'd never traveled by myself. I wasn't allowed to go away to school for college. The immigrant girls, I wasn't allowed to leave. So my dad sent my mom with me on my first business trip to keep me safe. But I walked in with my little flip chart of my sales presentation, and she emailed me recently, and she said, "Your presentation was the most passionate one. It was so real. It was so different than everything I saw." And she took my product and the whole grocery store at Lucky's, and my father could not believe guy had done that. And that was his first sale that anybody else had made aside from him.
Wow.
So that was when we were about $6 million in revenue. So in like 1997. Once that happened, like he was really proud of, you know, some of those wins that I had, and he was teaching me everything. He wanted me to be like a sponge. Mm-hmm. And he really empowered me. He you know, when Danone, Group Danone, had acquired 20% of our company, and he was alive for that. He drove that. But in all of the due diligence, it was just me and him. Mm-hmm. And he trusted me to do that, to lead it. So here I was, like 22, negotiating with the CEO of Danone in Paris. I mean, a multi-billion-dollar multinational company. And I didn't even understand how large that was. I was just doing my thing, my passion for my business and my product. And so, you know, he really empowered me. And, you know, he said at shareholder meetings, he always had me do presentations and he always pushed me out front. And when he was asked about a week before he passed away, it was like a sign or a message to me. One of the shareholders said, "It's well, Mike, you're like a one-man act. What happens if something happens to you?" And he said, "My children have learned everything about the business. I have no fears that anything, there would be an issue in a transition." And hearing that message was really important for me. To hear it from him was really important. So when he had a heart attack, when he suddenly had his heart attack when I was 27 and he was 55, it wasn't even a question for me that I could take over, because he had told me that I could. Mm. And I had learned a lot from him.
What were those first 24 to 48 hours after he died like for you?
It was one of the most traumatic things that I think anyone will go through, especially if it's a sudden experience. But I think any time when you lose your parent, it's incredibly traumatic. It was sudden. He had a heart attack, unexpected. And he was like in the prime of his life. He was the center of our community. He was it shocked people, like beyond it shocked me. And, you know, one thing that I remember is in this moment of crisis, my fierce sense of protection for the company and the people who work with us and for us and our vendors and our suppliers and all of our customers. And, you know, there was his best friend 3 feet away from me was talking to somebody else and being so like as though I didn't exist or see me, says to me or says to the other person, "There's no way a 27-year-old girl could run this company. The company's over. It's done.
Jeez.
Sell your stock. There's no more Lifeway. It's over."
Wow.
And I was so angry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my fight or flight response is so strong. The fight, that warrior instinct in me, my survival instincts, my resilience, all of that came to the top. I was like fire, you know, and I didn't even say anything to him, but I just went into my father's office that night, and I got to work, and I haven't stopped. And I proved him wrong, obviously. So that inspires me every day to this day. And I am so grateful. You know, at the time I was really resentful of it. But today, and, you know, I look at it with such gratitude. I say thank you to the haters.
Did you do anything special in those early days just to get yourself out of bed, right? Because you've got the stress, you've got the critics, you've got the grief.
I was in such shell shock that I was just running on endorphins. It was a rough 4 years. The first year, I don't remember a whole lot. It's such a trauma. It's such a crisis, just to stabilize everything. But I remember, like, doing things like we didn't have a sign in front of the building. And I was like, we need a sign. And, you know, it was the most insignificant decision in the business, but I needed to make a decision. You know, I needed to just make decisions and do something, take some kind of action. And it was like, I just remember being obsessed with the sign and like how I needed to have a sign in front of the company so that everyone knew that Lifeway is here and we're not going anywhere.
What advice would you give to women who want to take that stretch job or a job that other people say, "Oh, you're not ready for that"?
Do it. Who says you're not ready? I mean, you know, we all have skills and things to bring to the table. No one is going to give you power. Just take it. You just have to take it.
Lifeway is a niche company that basically sells kefir-related products, and you are a trendsetter. But trends can also turn. So right now, milk consumption in the United States has declined significantly, and several dairy producers have closed. Milk is the main input for your flagship product. So how are you dealing with those industry pressures?
Yeah, it is an interesting time. I honestly never thought I would see the day when dairy has been demonized like it has been. And I think it's, the pendulum will swing. I don't think it's forever. I think, like, we've seen this with fat-free and, you know, carb-free and Atkins diets. I don't think it's necessarily going to always be like this. I think it's in part a little bit of a trend. At the same time, I do believe that the plant-based movement is not going anywhere. I think that, for us, we saw this happening about 4 years ago, and we started to innovate and formulate a plant-based dairy-free alternative. So we just recently launched Plantiful, which is a plant-based dairy-free probiotic alternative. So, you know, Plantiful is really, it really appeals to people who are concerned about the environment, who are making the changes for climate change reasons. We're hearing that. Now, the great thing is that, again, kefir is, our traditional authentic kefir is a 2,000-year-old product that survived war and famine and, a very storied history. That it tells me, and I am 100% certain that kefir will continue to exist for another 2,000 years.
So looking back, what advice would you give to the 27-year-old Julie?
Don't worry. It all works out. To trust the universe and to enjoy the ride. I have spent a lot of energy in the course of my life in a place of anxiety, and a lot was kind of on my shoulders, a lot of responsibility, and I didn't always show that to the outside world, but I'm going to, like, tear up, but I carried that a lot, and, today I wish I maybe spent less time in anxiety and more time really, you know, just confident that it would be okay.
We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we recently checked back with Julie to see how she's adjusted to industry pressures and COVID-19.
Don't you wish your life came with a warning app?
That dog does not want to be petted.
Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the 1-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
Great to see you again, Julie.
Good to see you. Or virtually, at least.
You too. First, how are you doing?
Well, I'm doing well. I think we're all kind of settling into the new normal and maybe stabilizing after, you know, the initial shock of March and April and getting, you know, adjusted to how things are going to be. It seems like we are, you know, we've gone through like a collective trauma of sort, and now we are adapting to what the reality is and trying to navigate and kind of figure out what this new normal is for everybody. So, initially I think there was a lot of adrenaline in play for us to respond, for leaders to respond, and for everyday families just, you know, trying to understand what this kind of crisis means to us individually, collectively, to our communities. our family members, loved ones, companies, workplaces. I mean, that's why it's a global pandemic. You know, we're all going through a whole range of emotions, and, you know, myself included. And yeah, I think it's just been exhausting is an understatement. And I think just adjusting.
One of the things we talked about pre-pandemic was how dairy had taken a hit. So I'm just wondering, how are you adjusting to the industry pressures amid coronavirus?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because we aren't just a straight dairy. We're also fermented. And fermented foods and gut health are really thriving. You know, one of the challenges was keeping up with the demand. And I think we've learned a lot in this process because, you know, being an essential business, we've remained operational and we've really been like working on overtime just to keep up with the demand on top of the extra demands from food pantries and supplying healthcare workers. You know, we've already delivered over 70,000 servings of product to food pantries, which has not been easy, you know, in the middle of a global pandemic, you know, just navigating all these changes in protocol and, you know, first and foremost, keeping the teams healthy and making sure that, you know, that everyone was aware of the changing protocols, which sometimes was changing by the minute and by the hour, you know, keeping up to date with CDC guidelines and just, you know, making sure that we knew as much information as was happening. And this situation is so fluid, and just trying to be, you know, 3, 4, 5 steps ahead of it has been really, I think, the stressful things.
You know, you're talking about ramping up production because of higher demand. I know the coronavirus has had a major impact on several factories. So I'm just wondering, how has Lifeway been affected? And have you had to close any factories or plants?
Well, all of our plants have remained operational, but we have rotated workloads to allow for some temporary stoppages and, you know, to allow preventative maintenance to happen to protect the health and safety of our employees. We've been able to reconfigure our facilities and workflow to make social distancing part of our procedures. We also have 3 production facilities, which has been which has given us the capability to work in different segments and increase our deep cleaning and sanitization schedules. Those were some, you know, really key kind of intuitive things that we started very early on in this. We started to cross train our staff, working in various phases, beginning with the most complex production, covering all the bases down to shipping, warehousing, storage, really being proactive and following that intuitive gut feeling. I had an impending sense of doom, I think, the very first week of March. That inner intuition, that gut feeling, I think really saved us here, and being proactive saved us lots of headaches. But more than that, I think saved lives and helped keep our team as safe as possible. You know, building extra inventory. I remember in the first week of March, I told and directed the team to start to build about 7 weeks of inventory. And this made it a lot easier to shift as the situations were changing. You know, this was not rocket science for us in terms of what we needed to do. I'm really happy that we kind of took the risk and ramped up our inventory, despite the fact that in food manufacturing, it's well known that everyone is doing just-in-time manufacturing. Most food companies, most food distributors, most retailers only have about 3 days of inventory on hand at any given moment. So to take this big dramatic step and, you know, within 2 weeks produce 7 weeks of inventory is unheard of. It is not something that is done. And so then when the stockpiling order started to come through mid to late March, we were able to turn it around and deliver on that increased demand.
What has this pandemic taught you about entrepreneurship?
Well, so many things. It's not about who has the most money. It's not about who has access to the most intelligence or the highest, you know, degrees, let's say, in a, you know, it's not about that. It's about survival is really about the ability to adapt and respond to that situation that's ahead of you and playing the cards that are dealt to you and finding the opportunities and pivoting when you need to. It's also taught me about compassion, about recognizing that everyone is approaching this pandemic from a different point. So, you know, understanding and having that compassion and empathy to see that all of us are seeing this from a different place, and to also understand the privilege and to check that privilege, to know that, you know, that I have a different privilege than somebody else does, and that I should, you know, also be aware and compassionate about that. And again, be grateful for those essential workers, you know, the truckers, the farmers, the grocery store checkout count, workers, you know, everyone, all of supply chain, how much we rely on them for our day-to-day life. You know, this is a marathon. It's not a sprint. That's another thing that I've learned and continue to learn. I've run several marathons, but those lessons that I've taken as a runner, as an athlete, as an endurance athlete, I've definitely been thinking about the big picture in these last few weeks. You know, recognizing self-care, this is I'm in the business of self-care, that it's important for myself too. It's so easy as an entrepreneur type A, you know, someone who thrives in crisis. Like, I'm very comfortable in crisis. I know crisis very well, that I also have to at some point crash and take care of myself. But the great thing is, at this point, I have a good toolbox of things that I know are helpful to me and that I want to encourage others and offer it to as many people as possible.
Thanks again for coming on. It was great to catch up with you, Julie.
Oh, thank you so much. It was great to talk to you and share.
Thanks again to Julie for joining us. If you'd like to hear more stories of inspiring women, you can find us on Apple, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or your favorite audio provider. If you like us, subscribe, share us on social media, and give us a review. Our producer is Trine Nori. Our executive producer is Kateri Yoakum. Additional help from personal finance editor Bray Lamb. I'm Veronica Dagger. Hang in there, Secrets listeners. You've got this. Thanks for listening.